A remote fantastical kingdom far from Europe's chancelleries of power. An ancient castle where secrets are walled up. An unpopular monarch on the eve of his coronation. A ruling class of plotters and would-be usurpers. And a gentleman adventurer on holiday. No, not Ruritania in the 19th century, but the United Kingdom in the 21st. Stein's new book, The Prisoner of Windsor, is a contemporary inversion of Anthony Hope's classic, The Prisoner of Zenda. In the original, an English gentleman on vacation is called upon to stand in for his lookalike, the King of Ruritania, at his coronation. Over a century later, a Ruritanian on vacation in London is called upon to return the favour and stand in for an Englishman in an absurd fantastical kingdom where Brexit never quite happened. Plots are afoot. The Prisoner of Windsor by Mark Stein. Available in hardback and digital editions, or for a personally autographed copy, go to steinonline.com.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now.
Welcome along. April 17th, 2024. It is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time. 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland and beyond the Americas. 8 p.m. British Summer Time. 9 p.m. in Paris. 10 p.m. in Jerusalem. 10:30 in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran for the half-hour time zone. Midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. In Singapore and Hong Kong, 5 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne, 7 a.m. in Auckland, and a rather more convivial hour for the Kippers and Kedgeree in His Majesty's Dominions, further east across the Pacific. Years ago, April 17th, 1924, Henry Mancini was born in Maple Heights, Ohio. Composer, arranger, conductor, piccolo player, that was his first lasting hit. If you were in front of a telly in the 1950s, you'll know it as the theme from Peter Gunn. If you're at the movies in the 1980s, you'll know it from the Blues Brothers. But did you know it has words? No, not just my traditional recitation of the time zones, but a proper lyric. We'll hear it a little later. Feeling super wiped out today and operating in a fair degree of chaos. The chaos is pretty much self-inflicted, health-wise, I may need more blood. Shoot the crimson to me, Jimson, as we played on one of our shows last year sometime when that awful Vermont, what's it called? The University of Vermont Medical Center was refusing to give me any blood, and I had to be taken north of the border to my chums at the Royal Victoria. Anyway, I'll endeavor to stagger through to the end of the hour. At the District of Columbia Superior Court, Mann versus Stein is now cruising into its 13th year. Meanwhile, We are less than 2 months from my court date in the King's Bench Division of the English High Court against the UK media censor Ofcom. I thank all of you who, in order to show support for one or other or both of these free speech cases, have bought a chum, a Stein Online gift certificate or a Mark Stein Club gift membership. These are bad times for freedom of speech. In Belgium, the mayor, the Burgermeister of Saint-Josse-ten-Noude, ordered his coppers to shut down the European National Conservatism Conference. But the court, the Conseil d'État, the highest administrative court in Belgium, struck down his order. So I believe today's events went ahead as scheduled. In America, the courts are mostly on team shut up. A hack judge in Lower Manhattan is widening his gag order on what he will permit one of the only two candidates for president to say in public. By the way, if you're wondering whether that mayor, Emir Kier, is Flemish or Walloon, actually, he's a Muslim. It's a majority foreign-born neighbourhood in which, last time I checked, I think it was 6 out of the 7 councillors were not born in Belgium. Odd place to book, somewhat carelessly, perhaps, a Euro-nationalist conference. Let us get to your questions. And Alison Castellina, what a mellifluous name. Alison Castellina, with her mellifluous name, asks, since Mark is partly Belgian, I'm not majority Belgian. So I'm rather like that municipality that just screwed over all those so-called national conservatives. I'm semi-Belgian. Actually, I'm more Belgian than that municipality. I'm more Belgian than most Belgians these days. Anyway, Alison says, since Mark is partly Belgian, did the mayor of Brussels back down over his ban on the Farage and Orban Conservative conference in Brussels due to Belgian prime ministerial pressure, EU elite pressure, or something else? Why did he think he'd get away with it in the first place? Well, as I said, the court has just shut it down. What was interesting? There's certain aspects of this that are interesting to me. For a start, there are members of governments. This is national conservatism, so it's so-called right-wing people from all over Europe. So my former colleague, extremely former, Nigel Farage was there. So too is the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban. So too is a former Minister of the Crown, Suella Braverman. So too is a former French presidential candidate, Eric Zemmour. So these are not people who operate on the fringes. You know, one of them is a European head of government. Another is the guy largely responsible for leading the campaign to get Britain out of the European Union. Another is a former Home Secretary, as I said, Monsieur Zemmour, French presidential candidate. So they're not up against, you know, this isn't QAnon types or whatever. And this is a very tone-policed crowd. I think I saw that on Twitter earlier today. I forget the name of the guy who organised this thing, but he's, like Nigel, he's very concerned about tone. So, for example, he held a similar conference in America and he banned Peter Brimelow from VDare.com. He banned Peter and his wife from attending the conference because it's all about the tone. So he's not one of these, he doesn't want any, you know, people who are too far right, as they say, at his conference. And so he holds this conference in Brussels and this mayor, this Muslim mayor of Saint-Just, says, we're going to send a message that we don't want the extreme right meeting here. This is what's going to happen to you, folks. Doesn't matter how much. I'm sympathetic. I've quoted Nigel's thinking on this beforehand, that when you form a new party, the first thing you have to do is accept it's going to be a one-man party, because the first 50,000, if you form a new party, the first 50,000 guys who want to join are going to be, extreme, boffer-booted, skin-headed, far-right type. So you form a party and you don't let anybody, you've got to police the tone. And And the tone policed found out in Brussels what happened. No matter how vigorously you police the tone and only have the respectable right, you're still, as this mayor said, you're still extreme right, and they're going to get you. And they're not going to let you. And what's interesting to me about this, as I said, there's various aspects. It's an interesting question from Alison. This site, it's called Claridge, where they're meeting. It's not the Claridges in London. It doesn't look as nice as that. But this is their third venue, because I forget which one the first one was. The second was the Sofitel. I've stayed in that Sofitel. It's quite a nice, not a bad place. I stayed there with my daughter a few years ago. And a rather nice hotel, but it's perfectly okay. But they kicked out these guys too. So you've got prime ministers, you've got home secretaries, you've got presidential candidates, and the Sofitel, which is one of the biggest chains, because they're part of that group that includes all the Ibis, those budget hotels. They've got all these different Mercure and Pullman, which are their mid-level chains. Then the Sofitel's their upmarket chain, and then Ibis is their budget chain. They've even got a budget Ibis, which is a kind of mind-boggling concept. But they're huge all over the continent, and they're not prepared to host a conference with prime ministers, ministers of the crown, presidential candidates. That's how advanced the big shut-up is in Europe. I tell you something, what was interesting to me is the coppers understood there was something iffy about this. A crappy little Islamo-Takia mayor boasting that he was sending a message that his political opponents are not welcome in his municipality, that his municipality is a one-party state. And the coppers understood there was something a bit iffy about this. So they surrounded the hotel, but they didn't actually have the guts to bust in and drag Nigel off the stage. And you know how Nigel works on these things. He would have been happy to have had that happen and to go along with it. But the other thing is, I found, that when they refused to let, so they sort of formed a perimeter, but they wouldn't let guys like Eric Zemmour go through the perimeter. And at that point, what you're going to do is call these guys bluffs. You're going to say to these guys, wait a minute, I'm supposedly in the capital of the European Union, which is the biggest collection of so-called democracies in the world. So if you don't mind, I'm coming through. You're going to have to get physical with me if you're going to try and prevent me. But Monsieur Zemmour and some of the others outside, and whether that included Suella Braverman or whatever, didn't. But this is the world, you're never going to be able to police the tone sufficiently to be acceptable to these guys. They are building a world without opposition. So if you say, oh, I'm not extreme right, I'm not hard right, I'm not far right, I'm ever so slightly, 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 slightly right of left of 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 centre right. That's all. Just a mere, barely detectable smidgenette. It's still not going to be enough for them. They're building a world without opposition. Eric Dale says, do you have any thoughts about the recent stabbing of a Syrian Orthodox priest, Mari Emanuel, during his YouTube live stream? Was Bishop Emanuel stabbed because he's a real threat to the status quo? If so, are the rest of the clerics pretty safe because they made it clear they're not a threat to anyone? Well, it's pretty true that your average Anglican bishop wouldn't really be worth going full Allahu Akbar on, but you never know. We were speaking of France just now. As I mentioned before, I attended the funeral of Père Hamel a few years ago after he was basically decapitated at Mass. Now, no one had done more for the Islamic outreach in his neighbourhood than that poor priest, and it didn't count for anything. In this case, I think it's fair enough to say that the Orthodox bishop was more outspoken than most clerics, and that there was a targeting. Other than that, you said, do I have any thoughts about him? My only thought is this, diversity is where nations go to die. And I mean that literally, in that you can see the old order dying before your eyes. And it amazes me that people, I don't understand why people, when somebody says diversity is our strength, people don't just pelt them with rotten fruit. This is an experiment at odds with the entirety of human history. The nation state is a somewhat unsatisfactory advance on the tribe. But as we moved from tribes to nation states, we understood that it's a complicating factor to have people who are too different in large numbers within those polities. That's simply reality in relatively modest terms. If you look at Ireland, if you look at Bosnia, if you look at Fiji, these are places that don't really make the headlines anymore, but for whom the differences within relatively compatible peoples are bedeviling. And so in the scheme of things, the differences between an Irish Catholic and an Irish Protestant are entirely minimal. The differences between an Irishman and an Englishman are entirely minimal. The differences between an English Canadian and a Purlen Quebecer are entirely minimal. But they have been bedeviling for centuries. So now we think that actually all that's irrelevant, and that a nation state is just like Gate 27 at Heathrow or LAX or wherever, and it's just an accumulation of whoever happens to be standing around in it. So Belgium, and I could have easily used this example, where the differences between, you know, my mother was a Flemish Catholic. There's not much difference between Flemish Catholics and French Catholics. Basically, Belgium has decayed into two separate halves, plus a capital region that happened to be in a personal union with the same monarch. That's it. There's not a lot of Belgium. As I think I've noted on some of our music anniversaries, they even have separate hit parades. So the point about somewhere like Belgium, it has Wallonia and Flanders, and that's been an obstacle to being a unified nation state, a functioning unified nation state. So the solution to that, they say, is, oh, okay, let's import everybody else. And there's no, so diversity is not our strength. Diversity is where nations go to die, and you are watching them dying in real time. Chris Davis says, is the High Court victory for Catherine Birbalsingh's Michaela School over the banning of prayer rites for a Muslim pupil an isolated outbreak of common sense or the start of some much needed pushback? If you're outside the UK and you haven't been following this story. This is about a school which has a lot of Muslim pupils, and one of them has very litigious parents and sued because they wanted Muslim prayer rites in schools. They lost in court, and headmistress Birbal Singh has written quite an interesting piece. I think it's over at The Spectator about it. Muslims comprise 50% of the pupils at the school, continues Chris. It's noteworthy that, this is a London school, by the way, it's noteworthy that, one, the action was taxpayer funded, two, the parents are considering further proceedings over another perceived slight against their child. Three, despite their lawfare, the parents still intend to send their other child to the school in September. I would make a couple of observations on that. When he says the action was taxpayer funded, what Chris means is that His Majesty's government picked up the tab for this litigious Muslim to sue the school. I forget what the total tab was, 150 grand or something like that. In the normal course of events, as you know, anywhere in the common law world outside America, if you bring a lawsuit and you lose, you're on the hook not just for your own costs, but also those of the prevailing party. In this particular instance, the British taxpayer is going to be picking up the tab for Miss Birbal Singh's plaintiff. As Chris notes, these particular parents are planning both more litigation and to send their other child to this school because it's quite a good school. And it's quite a good school because Ms. Birbal Singh, the headmistress, does not do what the other... There's two kinds of schools, basically, now in... certainly in England, and quite whether it's true to the same degree in Scotland, Northern Ireland or Wales. But there's two kinds of schools. There's ones where whatever they're called, and sometimes they'll be called, you know, St. Alphege's Church of England School, but it will in fact have been wholly Islamified. And anything that goes against the Islamic supremacists, you just brush under the carpet. No, so it's been completely Islamified. And then the other school is where, because of the diversity is our strength, multiculturalism, everything's just a void. And it's a big nullity. And in that nullity, children will seek their own identity. And these days, they can be pretty crazy. You might hope they just get a bit over-eager on the climate change bollocks. No, sometimes they decide, I'd like to cut my breasts off and be rendered infertile. That's part of that is the vacuum in which so much contemporary education occurs. But as I read what Catherine Birbal Singh is saying about her school, is that she writes a rather old-fashioned paean. I recognized a bit of myself in this from a long, long time ago, where you hope to construct a world, and a school is a very closed world, in which certain principles apply, so that, you know, okay, we've got some Anglicans, we've got some Catholics, we've got a couple of Jews, we've got rather more Muslims, but we will try to raise them all, treating each other with respect and all the rest of it. And it is necessary for the school to be able to set its own rules, to be able to do that. But I'm afraid, rather as with the big trans victory everyone's going on about in Britain, rather as with this court case, that I fear that it is simply an interim phase. She has won a battle, but the school over the course of the last decade has gone from 30% Muslim to 50% Muslim. So what's it going to be in another 10 years? 80% Muslim, 85% Muslim? That will, in the end, determine what kind of school it is. So I congratulate her on her great legal victory. But in a democratic age, the demographics will be dispositive, as they are in Saint-Josse in Belgium, where, as I said, the last time I checked, 6 out of 7 councillors were foreign-born. It's not Belgium anymore. London. I was in Saint-Josse, I would say, about 8 years ago. I was in Molenbeek, and I was in one of the other highly Islamized parts of, you know, Molenbeek, the, what's it called, the Chaussée de Gand, the Ghent Road, used to have all these, I remember it from my childhood, used to have all these kind of rather wacky shops in it, had a lot of Jewish shops there too. Oddly enough, all the Jews have gone. Why would that have been? Because diversity is merely an interim phase between what you were and the incoming homogeneity. Get real about this. You know, Nigel pussyfoots around this kind of talk as much as anybody because he wishes to be allowed to give speeches in the Sofitel. And the Sofitel kicked him out anyway. You know, we have to start moving the meter on this. We have to start moving the meter a bit more. Steve from Manhattan says the new Steve from Manhattan. He's not really from Manhattan. He's a Montenegrin brigand who was posing as my doorman at the DC Superior Court a couple of months back. But he tries to pass himself off as being a D's and O's. Well, no, not D's and O's. That's the Bronx, isn't it? Steve is from Manhattan. The New York Times today published an account by a reporter of her experiences at a Trump rally in Pennsylvania, the last before the start of his New York criminal trial. I was struck by this part of her report. It felt a little like the Who's down in Whoville gathering to sing after the Grinch stole Christmas. There was a vibe of unity, common purpose, faith and joy. I must say, continued, that was the New York Times lady. And then Steve adds, I must say that is consistent with my sense. Earlier generations of Americans have faced worse adversaries than the likes of Biden, Bragg and Blinken. What is your take of how sane people are responding to the marauding left these days? Well, you know, the adversaries are not Biden, Bragg and Blinken. These are just the feeble front men put up for the Potemkin version of self-government that the United States currently enjoys. There is a vast apparatus coordinating on all kinds of things, and the names of the people beavering away aren't really known, but it is vast, and like so many tyrannies, it is largely faceless. I saw a post that my friend John Hinderacker did over at Powerline today about this NPV movement, the National Popular Vote, which is an agreement between certain states that if, in the event that their presidential winner in that state is at odds with the national popular vote, then they will seat the winner of the national popular vote. They will seat his electors as the electors for their state. And there's a, you know, John has a touching faith in American institutions, so he gives some thought as to whether it's constitutional or unconstitutional. What I took away from it is they need to get two states with 270 electoral votes to, once they do that, they will have basically dissolved the Electoral College just through their ad hoc agreement. Maine's just signed on to it, and I think it's coming up again in Michigan or somewhere. They're within 50 votes of that. They've got something like 221 Electoral College votes in the bag. If they get to 270, then the Electoral College is dead. And that's a very good example of how the left is looking down the road, even as we're looking backwards in the rear mirror, and still, you know, all the Durham report, so that whatever it was, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years, whatever it was, after the shenanigans, Durham finally files his report. So they've head faked the right into always looking at the rearview mirror to investigate the shenanigans from the previous election or even the one before that. Well, they're moving on. For example, there's all this talk about whether the speaker, this month's speaker, is going to be toppled. There's moves afoot. I think some guy Massey, Congressman Massey, he's no longer supporting the current speaker. Well, you have to be very careful here. A vote here, a vote there. And next thing you know, the Democrat guy, Hakeem Jeffries, becomes the speaker and is in control of the House of Representatives, as Democrats are in control of the Senate. And what did the Supreme Court just rule when it said that the states could not kick Trump off the ballot? The only people with the power to kick Trump off the ballot is Congress. So you're going to be, you know, if you think the Democrats aren't already thinking, you never know, they're all getting a bit itchy twitchy over there. The ever shrinking Republican majority, it drops. Everyone's checking out of the House. It's falling. You know, they're getting ready. And the minute that happens, even if he were only to be Speaker for like 48 hours, this guy Jeffries, they'd be moving on this kick Trump off the ballot stuff. They're always looking down the road. They're cunning like that. Let us pause for a moment. It's kind of 1:30 exactly. We're not always this exact, so let us take advantage of our timeliness to pause a moment from the passing Charivari. As we heard at the top of the show, this very day is Henry Mancini's centenary. He was a great film score composer, which is an art all by itself. And it doesn't always mean you'll also be a great songwriter. But Mancini proved he was both on this particular film. In 1961, he was hired to score the picture, but they wanted to get in some big New York songwriting team to write the actual song. And he had to beg and plead and prostrate himself to persuade them to give him a shot at it. And he produced one of the biggest songs of the last 6 decades. A huge standard, but it was lucky to make the final cut. Here's Henry Mancini's lyricist on that song, Johnny Mercer.
Moon river, wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style. They had a preview of this picture, Breakfast at Tiffany's, in San Francisco. And they had one of those conferences afterwards. Didn't go too well, because it was a big hit, but it didn't go too well at this preview. So the producer, Marty Rackin, said, "Well, I don't know what you guys are going to do, but I'll tell you one thing, that damn song can go." Dee-da-da-dee-da. The same rainbows end, waiting round the bend. Huckleberry friend, Moon River, and me.
Johnny Mercer. He had great comic timing, Johnny Mercer. Remembering there, Marty Rackin, not just a producer, but the head of production at Paramount. And of course, Moon River became a far bigger song than the picture for which it was written, Breakfast at Tiffany's. But sometimes you can have too big a hit for the next half century or so. Whenever you called up your dentist secretary to make an appointment, Moon River was the tune playing while you were on hold. And when something's that ubiquitous, it becomes hard to hear it as a real song with a real emotional resonance. Here is a singer I used to love going to see in little clubs and whatnot back when I was a man about Manhattan. And I was always happy if she sang this song. And if she didn't, I would ask her to sing it. She died far too young. Her last ever TV appearance was on December 4th, 1995 on CNBC's Charles Grodin show. She sang this song for Mr. Grodin and then died 9 days later. But it's out there, waiting round the bend and crossed in style by Nancy Lamott.
I'm crossing you in style someday. Old dream maker, you heartbreaker, wherever you're going, I'm going your way. To
Nancy Lamott, the late Nancy Lamott, with her pianist Christopher Marlowe, words by Johnny Mercer, music by Henry Mancini, upon the occasion of his centennial this very day, Moon River. Nancy and I had the same birthday, same day, not the same year. Sammy Kahn and Paul McCartney did, as both of them mentioned to me on separate occasions. But Nancy had the same birthday as I did, and I think she was 42 or 43 when she died. And when I listened to her singing like that, I always thought at some point that an Eva Cassidy thing might happen to her posthumously. As you know, with Eva Cassidy's versions of Autumn Leaves and Over the Rainbow and so on, Eva Cassidy died around about the same time in the 1990s, but it has not so far proven the case. And I think a lot of that is to do with whoever's controlling her estate. Mark Stein live around the planet. It is 22 to 4 North American Eastern Time. That is 22 to 9 British Summertime. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent Earth. Let's get back to your questions. Oh, David Kelly Wood. Looks like this is on a related topic. Mark, straying dangerously from the light-hearted subject of the collapse of civilization to the far more meaningful one of your love of music, do you recall there ever being a light bulb moment, say maybe a particular song or circumstance, when you said to yourself, hey, this music thing is going to be pretty special in my life? I can't remember ever not liking music. My father, I remember parents of my friends, always had a lot of LPs and singles in his collection. And I remember when friends would come round, we'd riffle through them. We'd play our lousy things, whatever we were into, at 13 or 14, and then we'd start exploring the more arcane corners of his collection. And a lot of the records I played then, like Buddy Greco singing Girl Talk, which he had the single of, I still like to play. I remember, he'd have these things where he'd get into a sort of groove on something and he'd just play it over and over. So things like the soundtrack album of The Music Man, he played all the time at a certain point in my childhood. So you become, simply because you hear it so often, the song in The Music Man, whatever it is, it's years since I've heard it. Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, let me say it once again. But Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, that's the town that knew me when. Or whatever it is, however it goes. And it fascinated me, because if you're not American, you mainly hear about all these towns from songs. I thought, wow, that Gary, Indiana, what a great song. It must be a great town. And then I went to Gary, Indiana, and when I was in the Chicago Sun-Times in Conrad Black's day, they also owned the Gary Post in Gary, Indiana. So I appeared every week in the Gary Post in Gary, Indiana, and every so often, I'd get invitations because I had fans in Gary, Indiana, to go and see it. But I remember remarking to my father, Gary, Indiana has a higher murder rate than Belfast did at the height of the so-called Irish trouble. And my father didn't believe that for a moment. But I think a lot of the things he used to play stuck with me. And I remember he used to have a terrible... he used to do good musical jokes. I remember one night, me and my pals, we'd been to the pub, and then we got kicked out of the pub and we went somewhere else. And we roll up like at 2 a.m, we all come in and we're like being all very rowdy and we're playing whatever rubbish we were listening to at the time. I can't remember what it was, Procol Harum or Emerson, Lake and Park, but some terrible progressive rock tracks that go on for 20 minutes apiece or whatever. And he used to, and then we all go upstairs and go to sleep. And he used to have, which I think was quite unusual in those days, he actually had speakers for his stereo in my mum and dad's bedroom. And so he'd obviously been annoyed because we'd kept him awake till 4 a.m. So like at 5:45, he got up and he moved the speakers from his bedroom. So outside my bedroom and the rooms my pals were staying in. And he put on Frank at full volume, Frank Sinatra, just outside our doors, Frank Sinatra singing, "I couldn't sleep a wink last night." He had good musical jokes, did my dad. So I'd say a lot of it comes from that. The notorious Mr. J says, "No politics for now. I'd like to ask a question about the state of popular music today. Specifically about allegations that computer algorithms are being used in the creation of modern pop hits. Do you give them any credence? Some of it does seem assembly line in feel." Really? You've only just noticed that, Mr. J. It is a concern since AI is demonstrating the ability to do some skilled plagiarism, that's what I think it should be called, with images and words. I'll be Luddite for a moment and call it nice software packages that let one store and steal styles with ease. Yeah, these are some really incredible things that were. What was I talking about just now? Procol Harum, Emerson, Lake and Park. If you take any song that is by some rock song, I don't know, Deep Purple, Smoke on the Water, you can now get AI. You can go, this will be 2 minutes on the internet to come to bring this up. You now get AI, artificial intelligence, that would do Bing Crosby singing Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple. And it's not bad, if you don't mind the fact that it's a mere technical impression with no human feeling. It's not bad. It's not as good as the album of, what is that album called? I've got it in the attic somewhere. Oh, yeah, Bing Crosby's fantastic album from the late 60s, on which he sings Hey Jude, just because they put it on the stand in front of him. You know, na 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 Hey Jude. The album is called Hey Jude, Hey Bing. And Bing sings Hey. Now, it's not as good as that if you put, you know, Bing Crosby singing Call Me Maybe or whatever, or I Kissed a Girl and I Liked It, or whatever, you know, recent song, or Firework or whatever, which are just technical exercises and they don't have the human feeling that the real Bing doing Jay-Z or Beyonce would have brought to the song, because he could sing almost anything. But on the other hand, how much real human feeling do you hear in anything these days anyway? This is, in a sense, the logical out. Now, at the same time we're having this, you know, it's like everything else now has become been put in the hands of global cartels. Doesn't matter whether it's public health, doesn't matter whether it's digital currency. There's just going to be five woke billionaires controlling everything. And that will apply to things like music, too. And the interesting thing is, what happens if somebody realizes that as Mr. J says, it's all getting to seem a bit assembly line? How are you going to get non-assembly line music? We're losing skills. For example, if you want a really good brass section outside London, New York and Los Angeles, very, very hard to... You couldn't, you know, I mentioned Frank Sinatra. To really play a Nelson Riddle chart at top form, there's only a handful, maybe. I said London, New York, Los Angeles, but I'm accepting for the purposes of argument that there may be a really hot brass section somewhere I haven't thought of. We're losing a lot of skills. We're losing a lot of skills. And the thing is, once they've turned it, once it becomes AI, so you don't... Well, what do you need those skills for? We've got a computer that is going to be able to play you the Moonlight Sonata as Beethoven wrote it. Oh, that's great. That's great. everything is going to be like that too, including the food you eat, the bugs, which will all be from the five global food hubs. Amar Marzouk says, what a time to be alive. Normally hear you in Australia as a delayed event, but now in France doing a Camino and actually get to hear as it happens. First time ever. No kippers and kedgeri for me. You can find other things to eat in France. Don't walk into three rosette Michelin restaurant and demand another shrimp on the barbie. Make the most of the local cuisine. Hope health keeps improving. Thank you for that. Would like your take on the jury process and the trial in New York. From distance of Australia or France seems a joke. Amar Marzouk. Yeah, you know, a jury of your peers is, in most countries, is the first 12 guys to walk in the room. You don't have all this thing that goes on for weeks, whatever they call it, voir dire, where you get to quiz them. What happens, I'll tell you from my own experience a couple of months ago in the District of Columbia, is you have a jury pool. There's hundreds of them. They're brought into, if you're in a, depending on the size of the courtroom, they're brought in 50 or 100 at a time, and they sit in the public benches, and you all introduce yourselves. And then the judge gives them a form, and the form asks them questions related to aspects of the trial. And so in my case, they ask them about climate change. And then they're brought in one by one, and you're they're quizzed on the questions that the judge has come up with. And so what was interesting about my jury pool is that they say, well, where do you get your news from? And so they all say, I read the Washington Post, I read the New York Times, I listen to NPR, right? These were the ones. But some of them actually said the BBC. So imagine how my heart sank. And it's exactly the same as this one in New York, except that because my case was lost once the jury was selected. You know, you have these jury selection consultants that you pay hundreds of thousands of dollars from, who claim to be able to divine certain hopeful nuances in this or that juror. And then so they pick the jury, and then they empanel another bunch of reserve jurors, because so many of them, you know, just in case one decides to not show up, then you move to the next juror in line, becomes on the panel. And so they're all hopeful about the one who's like four jurors outside the jury right now, because she seemed to indicate that she might be a little climate change skeptical or something. So, that'd be great if we can only knock out these three or four jurors. We'll get, it's all rubbish, all that. And it's particularly bad in the New York system because you have a corrupt judge. And so the judge, you have a nakedly political trial in which you have a jury that is not just all Democrats, because that's what New York City is, but also it refines itself. So then Democrat donors and Joe Biden volunteers and all kinds of things. And that's why, as I said, the result, as with my case, the result is a foregone conclusion. And in that case, Trump should just ignore the instructions from this corrupt judge and attend his kid's graduation. You're right that it would be different in Australia. It would be different in France. But the corruption of the judicial system is near total now. Robert Fox writes, Mark, the DNC is using the judicial system of New York like Iran uses Hamas. I know our members of Congress are too busy robbing us blind. Send money now to sendmoneynow.com. That's what matters. That's how you judge the health of a self-governing society. How quickly you're prepared to give your credit card number and send money now to sendmoneynow.com. I know our members of Congress are too busy robbing us blind, but wouldn't you think at least a few governors and legislative leaders, especially from red states, would raise hell about what is happening to Trump? After all, they could be next. Yeah, it's exactly like that conference in Saint-Josse in Belgium where... You know, they're all saying, oh, yeah, you know, we can't have this guy, we can't. They're all, that's all a bit too red meat. So we'll just dial it back, dial it back, dial it back. You can't dial it back enough. You can't dial it back enough. They're going to, once Trump's out of the way, they'll be coming. You don't think, say the Republican Party had done what all the never-Trumpers like Bill Kristol had done and just said, oh, we can't do this. He's being indicted every 20 minutes. We've got to throw him overboard. Okay, let's say you managed to sell that to the Republican base and they went for someone else. You think they're just going to sit back and let Mike Pence or whoever win? No. When the narrative, and again, here's the big, I said this last week and I don't want to repeat it, but I learned it very well, because when this rubbish with the Human Rights Commissions was brought in the 1960s in Canada, everyone said, oh, it's just like a mopping up operation after the Second World War. We've got these like neo-Nazi guys living in their mum's basement in the middle of Saskatchewan. And, you know, every so often they go to the Xerox machine and they print 10 copies out and put them up in telephone booths around Swift Current. So it's just a mopping operation for that. And then it moves inward until eventually they're dragging into court the guy who wrote what at that time was the number one best-selling book in Canada over an excerpt that appeared in the number one news magazine in Canada, Maclean's, the quintessential dentist's waiting room magazine. It always moves inward. And so if you don't actually, there's no such thing as being, oh, once they're done with Trump, all this will go away. No, they've got a taste for it because it actually works for them. Finding, again, with this stupid hyper-politicized judicial system, works for them. And so the idea that, and you say, why aren't governors speaking up about it? Well, governors have to calculate. You know, if you're a red governor in a blue state, you're maybe, you know, you see the polling numbers and, you know, the guys you want to re-elect you are kind of semi on board with what's going on. The so-called swing voters, the independents. But I don't understand why the conservative commentary itself, even Grant, well, I do understand. It's because they're all owned by, you know, corporations that have their own various interests. But the fact is, the conversation isn't anywhere near it where it needs to be. And again, it's the same thing as happened in Belgium. I don't, you know, I'm because of my personal experience with him, I'm obviously wary of Nigel. But Nigel isn't, the idea that Nigel gets taken out by this Muslim mayor when Nigel, no one has been more cautious about ever addressing the remorseless demographic transformation of Britain and Europe than Nigel has. You can trim your sails, but the tsunami will still get you in the end. Penns Woods writes, Mark, could you give us your take on the what has to be some backroom discussions between Turkey, Iran and the US prior to the airstrike? As someone else suggested, this is weird. Yeah, this is really, if you think about it, incredibly high stakes. The Israelis took out the general who is supposed to have been the Iranian general who is supposed to have been the mastermind behind October 7th. Now, October 7th was the biggest corpse count of Jews since the Holocaust. And I know there's a big difference of opinion on that, and there's generational differences. In the immediate war on terror era after 9/11, the best friends of Israel in the West were American evangelicals. Now, according to which polls you see, something like the children of those Israeli-loving evangelicals are all like everybody else's kids, all hot for Palestine. But I'm just saying, put aside whatever you feel about this thing. When you've had that number of people killed, when you've had that number of people raped, when you've had that number of people taken hostage, and some of them are still hostages, including citizens of nations like the United States that keep telling Israel it has to stop responding to this stuff. There's five U.S. citizens. If they're not dead, they're somewhere in Gaza, right? You want to put your, you got an American passport? You want to put your faith in your State Department when you happen to be at a music festival in Gaza and the guys come for you? You think, oh, don't worry, mom and dad will be calling the State Department and they'll take care of it. At any rate. They figured out that this general, Iranian general, was the mastermind, and they assassinated him. Unfortunately, for sticklers for international law, they did it. They droned him in a building that happens to be part of a diplomatic facility in Damascus. So the Iranians then figure they're going to respond. They've so far used just their proxies, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, but now they're going to have to actually respond. So we have negotiations going on in the week before Saturday's airstrike, using the Turks as a mediator. This is basically, if you've been in the lawsuits that I've been in, this is basically like I mentioned the jury selection questions. This is like all those scheduling pre-trial conferences where you meet and with the judge, and the judge agrees what questions are going to be asked and all the rest of it. So the Turks are mediating between the Americans and the Iranians as to the permitted response. Okay? So they you just imagine if you are living in Israel. This is what they're negotiating over. Oh, yeah, well, you can have one night to lob whatever you want at Israel, and we're going to do our best to shoot down any incoming. All it would have required, because we're told now that the Americans, which I have no reason to disbelieve it, but that the Americans were responsible for downing most of the cruise missiles, most of the ballistic missiles, most of the drones. I would figure that that's a reasonable supposition. Meanwhile, there's Israel. So this is I can't really think of equivalents to this, but this is the equivalent of the guys at number 2, number 4 and number 6 Elm Street agreeing that they're going to let the guy at number 6 firebomb the house at number 12 Elm Street, but just for one night. And don't worry, because they'll be able to get all the incoming before it actually takes out the people in the house. Imagine if just one of those ballistic missiles had actually gotten through and hit a dense urban area. And then they'd said, oh, I don't know what you're making such a fuss about. This is all part of the plan that the Turks, the Americans, and the Iranians agreed. Absolutely extraordinary. You know, and it's amazing that it held up and they took them all out with Israel, apart from that poor girl. And actually, you know, she's not negligible. The 7-year-old Bedouin girl who's still in hospital. She just happens to be in the middle of nowhere, a Bedouin encampment in the middle of the desert, and gets injured by shrapnel from one of the Iranian incoming. But you imagine if that were if that were Rome, if that were Paris, if that were Berlin, those cities would be in flames. And yet we have, you know, and this guy Kirby, the rear admiral, and he's a rear admiral. Oh, what ships did he? He doesn't command any ships. He's not that kind of rear admiral. He's a press agent for the National Security Council. He's a flack. If he was on Broadway, they'd call him a flack. Or Hollywood, they'd call him a flack. But because he's in the White House, they call him a rear admiral. So this pathetic. I can't stand that. You think to yourself, well, he's a four-star admiral. Oh, really? That's great. Did he win the Battle of whatever? He's just some rather unprepossessing tranny who's an affirmative action appointment to the Department of Health admiral. Gets to walk around dressed like an admiral. Anyway, John Kirby, also an admiral. I'm not sure whether he's transgender, but he ought to be. Anyway, he goes, oh, this was fantastic. What a night. We pulled it off perfectly. He's drooling like this because he designated the nice little Jewish couple at number 28 Elm Street as the target for these war games that the Iranians have permitted. Absolutely incredible. People talk about this as if it's normal. It's not normal. It's actually sick. Bill Decker writes, Dear Mark, the National Post recently published an opinion piece by Conrad Black with the headline, Only After Hamas Is Destroyed Can There Be a Palestinian State. While I do not think Lord Black is wrong, I am not sure eliminating Hamas and rejigging borders can be a lasting solution while Iran and other actors continue to fund, train, supply, and encourage other terrorists such as Hezbollah, Houthis, and other groups, whether or not their names start with the letter H. What do you think? Is removing Hamas going to cause a domino effect towards peace, or will someone else simply move in with Iran's backing? Keep well, and thank you for what you and your team are doing, says Bill from the unfashionable time zone in Alberta. Yeah, we never get to that. We never actually make landfall as we move across the Pacific. People have complained about that. And Andrew Lawton, when he guest hosts, does some of the Western North American time zones. But to get to your substantive point, I disagree with Conrad. I'm not really interested in a Palestinian state. You know, the thing about, as you know, if you followed events on the 100 Years Ago show, we covered in real time the creation of the Irish Free State in 1922. Now, the thing about that is that as unsatisfactory as it was to Irish Republicans, and as unsatisfactory as it was to Irish Unionists, who would have preferred the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland to continue, what's interesting to me is that the minute they'd agreed, London and the rebels had agreed, the Irish just got on with setting in motion the mechanisms for establishing a government. In other words, they wanted to have a highway department, and they wanted to have an education department. And the transition, you know, given the circumstances, the transition from the old Dublin Castle regime of the Lord Lieutenant to these new guys coming in, it's not exactly as you see it in some of these stupid films they make about it, and so in some of the ridiculous self-mythologizing to which our Irish friends are prone. But the fact is that the Irish were serious about getting on with running their own country. What is happening in what has happened now in the 30 years since the Oslo Accords is that there's no sign of that. These are terrorist squads. Because, and I say terrorist squads because regardless of whether the majority of people are engaged in killing Jews, the fact is the viable political class, both in the West Bank and even more so in Gaza, is into killing Jews. That's the thing. So the idea that it's about a land for peace thing is completely ridiculous. I'm not in favour of a two-state solution because there's enough. There's whatever there are, 58 crappy Muslim countries in the, whatever it's called, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation or whatever it is. It's the biggest voting bloc in the UN. Sooner or later, and actually on the present numbers sooner, a whole bunch of Western European nations are going to be joining them. I think there are, and at that point, what will it be up to? 60, 75 Muslim country. It'll be getting close to half the nation states who are members of the UN. I don't think the world needs any more Muslim countries, not at the expense of a tiny little strip of Jews. His Majesty's government actually bears the blame for a large part of the problem. They took over the so-called Palestine mandate, and they immediately gave 55% of it away because they promised a gig to a Hashemite king, Hashemite prince, as he was then. And so they created the Emirate of Transjordan. And if they hadn't given that 55% away, immediately they got the Palestine mandate, you could have had a far more equitable division between Jews and Arabs. But I'm not interested in that. I'm interested. So all this two-state solution arises from the do-gooders of the world fetishizing the Palestinians, so-called, as their house pet. Palestinian basically is an invented concoction anyway from the 1960s. As you know from the Cable Street riots in the East End of London, Oswald Mosley's guys, the British fascists, their big slogan for that rally was Jews back to Palestine. OK, so the Jews go back to Palestine and now it's Jews out of Palestine. Funny how that works. But anyway, what I think I'm not interested in cobwebbed do-gooderism. That is now half a century to three quarters of a century out of date. However, I am mildly interested in reality. And the reality is that the Sunni Arabs and Iran do not have the same interest. And the Sunni Arabs do not want to be Iran's prison bitch, which is basically the future they're looking at once Israel is gone. So a potential alliance between the saner Sunni Arabs, by which I mean, you know, the Emirates and Jordan and one or two other places, is something real in a way that Western bleating about two-state solutions is not. That's just my thoughts on it. Pete Procopio says, Mark, I think most of us have a sense of how things turn out for Trump in this ultra-corrupt New York case. I'd like to hear your thoughts on how this nonsense will be resolved. Can you channel the Maha? It's the Maharishi, and read the stitches on this fastball. Will the progressive vultures achieve their objective? I know the process is the punishment, but this feels like more. I agree. The thing here is the case isn't about the case. There's actually no controversy to be adjudicated by the court. They've invented a reason to keep him in court, to put him in court. They're doing this to destabilize the election. So these court cases are about Tuesday in November. And the problem for them was that just if you believe some of these recent polls, Trump had opened up such a gap in the swing states particularly that stealing it, for the Democrats to steal it, would require far more effort than it did in 2020. What they want to do, now is what all this stuff is about. It actually doesn't matter whether it's in America, whether it's in Canada, whether it's in Belgium. What it's all about is there is to be no permitted course correction. No permitted course correction. So that even people who talk about course correction, because, you know, in the end, whoever you elect, you know, you elect Georgia Maloney and, you know, they have a quiet word with her and suddenly there isn't any course correction. But they don't actually want any course correction, which is why they're moving on to. They've got all these plan B, plan C, plan B. Congress is slipping out of the Republicans' control. Another resignation here, another resignation there. And soon we'll be able to vote, as the Supreme Court hinted we should, at maybe banning Trump from the ballot. Oh, well, that's not going to. Okay, well, what we're going to do then is we're going to pass laws to make it impossible for the so-called chief executive, the head of the executive branch of the United States, to actually do anything when he's won the election. This is all what it's about. And the funny thing is, you know, they're getting very reckless with this, very reckless. And people talk about, oh, Trump will be taken out and all the rest of it. I wouldn't. If I were Trump, I wouldn't trust my own. Somebody said that Trump should have taken my advice, climbed into the back of my pickup and let me drive him across the New Hampshire-Quebec border and thence to Newfoundland, the ferry to Saint-Pierre and Miquelon. And then he could take the Air France flight from Saint-Pierre over to Paris and go somewhere that doesn't have an extradition treaty with the United States. Unfortunately, he's surrounded by the Secret Service. And do you think if he would say to them, guys, today, you can have the day off today because I'm having this guy in New Hampshire who's just going to drive me over to the border. Don't worry about it. I'm just going to take Melania shopping in Montreal for a weekend. Do you think... Do you think he'd be allowed to leave the country? They don't want a prince across the water. You know, they want a tea. And it's not even particularly about Trump, as he says. It's not about me. I'm just in the way of them getting to you because they're trying to teach you a lesson. Carolinen says the realms of law and of manners that Mark has spoken of are of limited extent. Trump lives outside both. That's true. When he chose publicity as his goddess, he therefore chose Aeschylean nemesis as his fate. No theory of secular justice can be applied to him, or as Clint Eastwood teaches us, deserve has got nothing to do with it. The justice bureaucracy was not constructed to handle a Trump. Feeding him into the gears can only muck it up. Are we not expecting too much of it? That's a rather a good point there. That's been true so far that, in a sense, what's been going... He's too big for it, so... This stuff doesn't really work for him. Toby Pilling says Western civilization may be sliding off a cliff, but the crapservatives have decided to spend parliamentary time ensuring that smoking will be illegal for an increasing proportion of British society as the years pass. I feel like taking up the consumption of tobacco for the first time, preferably pipe smoking, just to spite these clowns. Am I wrong? This is a vote in the You know, it's again, it's one of these totally uniparty votes. So all the parties, except for the Democratic Unionists, and I think about 50 Conservatives, voted to forbid anyone born after January 2009 from ever smoking. And I have no idea why this should be a priority for, except that Rishi Sunak is a complete traitor, as are most of his cabinet, to any genuine conservative. There's no but if you're born after January, I forget the date, you know, whatever it is, if you're born on January the 7th, you'll still be able to buy cigarettes. But if you're born on January the 8th, you won't be. This isn't a priority for any. You know, we have runaway excess deaths in the United Kingdom. We have this sudden upsurge in all kinds of things, all kinds of health things that are nothing to do with smoking. And actually, as I look on it, I miss, I was never a smoker, never really enjoyed it, even when I was a teenager. But I miss smoking. Tell you why. Because people looked healthier, oddly enough. True, they might look healthy just for a bit and then they die. But when they were just walking around down Main Street, they didn't look as unhealthy as they do now. All kinds of things are worse since smoking was eliminated. American acting being one of them. Because it's amazing how if you give Lauren Bacall a cigarette, she can light up the room. But whoever her successors are now, who don't get to, you know, how to whistle, Steve, you just put your lips together and blow. You take away the cigarette from Bogey and Bacall and all the rest of it. And it's amazing how bad all the acting's gotten. I'm glad we found a non-political point on which, well, I suppose it is political, but, you know, it's nothing. There's nothing conservative about this. Where, and this is, you know, the takeaway here. You can't vote your way out of this unless you vote for the DUP in Ulster. But aside from the Democratic Unionists and 50 of the so-called conservatives, the rest of that rotten, worthless House of Commons is all on board with this severe infringement of liberty. There is nothing about smoking that should require the government of the United Kingdom for anyone to ban it for people born after 2009. This is Mark Steins, Clubland Q&A across the planet. Greetings to you, whether you are in some hellhole municipality in Belgium where your free speech rights have been taken away, or some hellhole county in the United Kingdom, where your right to have a quiet smoke has just been taken away. It's Henry Mancini's 100th birthday, and so we've ditched our usual theme tunes in order to celebrate a man who wrote terrific theme tunes. I played the late Nancy Lamott singing Moon River a while ago, and I can hear what some of you will have been saying. Golly, she's making an awful meal of it. It's all a bit intense for my taste. So here is an entirely different singer who, like Nancy, also died before her time, singing Mancini and Mercer about a decade after Nancy's recording. Because who doesn't sing Moon River? Here's Amy Winehouse.
Moon River, why do they smile? I'm crossing you in style to see you clear. Maker, you are a breaker. Wherever you're going, I'm going your way. There's a singing rainbows and waiting around the bend. My huckleberry friend, Moon River, and he's raining.
The late Amy Winehouse singing Henry Mancini and Johnny Mercer, Moon River. If she'd stuck to songs like that, she'd be less famous, but she'd still be alive. I said the Peter Gunn theme had a lyric written some years after the tune. It's difficult putting words to a melody that's already known because most of the time it winds up sounding like someone singing along to an instrumental. It's like putting words to Beethoven's Fifth or whatever. But this isn't bad, and it matches, I think, the drive of the tune. Sue Rainey is splitting. She's out of here.
Every night your line is busy. All that buzzing makes me dizzy. Couldn't count on all my fingers. All the dates you've had with swingers. Bye, bye. Bye, baby. I'm gonna kiss you goodbye and go right through that doorway. So now it's fair, you should stare at the back of my head. If you write a letter to me, my former friend, don't you end with an RSVP. I'm going bye-bye. I'm moving. Tomorrow I may be splitting to Britain or Norway. I'm saying bye. I have had it.
The fabulous Sue Rainey, with orchestra arranged and conducted by Alan Broadbent, and Henry Mancini's Peter Gunn theme with words by Hank's pals Jay Livingston and Ray Evans. Love them both. Great songwriting team, music and lyrics. Buttons and Bows, Que Sera Sera, Mona Lisa. Couldn't count on all my fingers all the dates you've had with swingers. I appreciate the sentiment, but while prepared to accept that fingers rhymes with swingers, or alternatively that swingers rhymes with fingers, I do not buy that fingers rhymes with swingers. Still, great record. And I wish Henry Mancini were around for his 100th birthday as he was for Irving Berlin's 100th birthday, which was the first time I met him long ago now. Happy 100th, Hank. Okay, I'm going bye, 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 baby, so long, I'm leaving. I'm not splitting for Britain, but I am going to take a nap in my camp chair in New Hampshire. Stick with Stein Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosen-Cohen will round up the internet as only she can. We will have a new tale for our time starting this Friday. And something else rather special coming this weekend. Our official Stein vs. the Stick trial merchandise is still available, only now it's the official merchandising for the appellate hearing. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même trial by ordeal, because that's the American way. If you don't fancy that, there's always a Stein Online gift certificate or a Mark Stein Club gift membership. Stay safe, stay free, stay well, stay out of court, especially if you're a high society jewel thief. Here's another great Henry Mancini theme tune.
Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.